This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Today, more cars are sold in China than in the United States. Chinese companies, many state-owned, are traveling the world to buy up oil to power them. And we are already going to extremes to keep our own fossil fuel economies going, blowing the tops off mountains for coal, the horrible tar sands, and now super-deep ocean drilling like BP's Gulf of Mexico blowout. And ours is the fossil economy. Every day, humans burn up fuels made from 5 million years' worth of solar power stored by ancient plants. We are burning it all at a rapid rate, loading up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. In fact, all our resources, from metals to rainforest, are being used up, turned into waste, at an incredible rate. Thanks to the glory of television and advertising, humans far from developed countries struggle to join in the final party. If everyone consumed even as much as Europeans, much less North Americans, it would take 3 to 8 planet Earths to do it. Billions want more, and we still want more. Pretty well everyone senses a collapse is inevitable as a natural reality and the laws of physics interrupt our endless party of population and consumption. The only question is, will we drain Earth until it dies? Or will we at least try to plan something else? There is an alternative. It's called degrowth, a planned and willing movement to end the mad economic system of endless growth based on endless consumption and pollution. An admission that really, to survive, humanity needs to shrink our demands upon the planet, to plan out a smaller economy and lower personal ecological footprints. It is time. This is Radio EcoShock. I suspect most EcoShock listeners, when they investigate degrowth, will feel like they're coming home, finally a name for what we know. On April 30, 2010, I attended and recorded one evening from a 3-day conference on degrowth. It was historic, the first such gathering in North America. European intellectuals and activists have been leading the development of degrowth. They have a long history and much wider recognition. The first international degrowth conference was held in Paris in April of 2008. There was another, the second conference on economic degrowth for ecological sustainability and social equity, held in Barcelona, Spain in March 2010. Each was remarkable for the wide range of academics and even government officials who attended. The need to limit greed and find alternatives to endless growth is better known in Europe. But a shrinking economy, even though that is obviously in the cards, is still shocking in the heartlands of Buy More, the United States and Canada. So it was a welcome beginning to find 300 people gathering in Vancouver, Canada for the first degrowth meetup on this continent. In this program, you will hear just a few samples from many presentations there, and nothing from the lively discussion circles hashing out the new vision and new rules for living on a limited planet. I'll start with a brief introduction by conference host and author Rex Wehler, a founder of Greenpeace, a member of the Vancouver Peak Oil Executive, and now the degrowth movement. We'll also get a short impression of the Barcelona conference from Tom Walker. Then it's time for heavy lifting, the ugly reality of our near-total dependence on fossil fuels that are running out. Even without the tragedy of climate change, peak oil expert Dave Hughes should frighten us all into low-energy life with sustainable power. From many speakers, I've also chosen Jack Alpert from the Stanford Knowledge Integration Laboratory. He'll tell us how many humans could live sustainably on Earth with modern lifestyles. Wait till you hear that number. Be prepared to grow as a human being, but shrink as a burden on the Earth. Let's get going on the biggest project this species has ever known, how to survive our own production.
This is the third degrowth conference in the world. First one that we know about was in Paris. And those of you who heard the French minister speaking last night on the film, very impressive. There are people in political positions in this world who get it, who understand the biophysical reality of what we're dealing with. And the first conference was in Paris. There was another one just recently in Barcelona. Tom Walker from Vancouver was in Barcelona at the degrowth conference there. this movement began to shake sort of economic circles about a decade ago. There was actually an uprising among PhD economics students in Paris, just like Paris 68, Paris 2010, only this was about 10 years ago, so Paris 2000. There was something of an uprising among PhD students, economic students in Paris. They insisted that their economics departments start talking about biophysical economics, ecological economics, and it was quite an upheaval because they couldn't say this was just a bunch of crazy radicals. These were the smartest economic students in France were saying we need to overhaul our universities. Then there was the degrowth conference in Paris. There was a degrowth conference in Barcelona. Tom Walker from Vancouver was in Barcelona. Tom is an educator, a researcher. He's written some important papers regarding the economic fallacies, the lump of labor fallacy, hours of labor fallacy. He's someone who knows how many of these systems work, and he's going to give us a short report from what he heard in Barcelona. Tom Walker.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I'm a growthaholic. Last month, I went to Barcelona to attend the second International Degrowth Conference. There were over 500 people in attendance from 40 countries, 50 papers presented, scientific papers, 80 posters. There were 28 working groups that met throughout the weekend. Now, being only one person, I was only able to go to one of the poster sessions and one of the paper sessions and two of the working groups. So I can't give you a picture of the entire conference, but you can download the posters and the paper abstracts from the Degrowth website. It's www.degrowth.eu. Get the full picture. What I'm going to do is give you my personal reflections on the conference, what brought me there in the first place, and what I took away, the main thing that I took away from the conference. At any rate, all the important stuff at conferences takes place in the corridors and off the conference site. So the big thrill for me was really making contact with Peter Victor, who is going to be teleconferencing into us tomorrow afternoon. So I really highly recommend that people attend tomorrow and hook into that teleconference and see Peter. What brought me to the conference, or what I brought to the conference, was this poster. This poster represents a culmination or a summary, a part of a culmination of about 15 years of research on working time that I've been engaged in. It also summarizes parts of book manuscript that I'm working on, and the title of that working title is The Gift of Prosperity. The basic idea that I'm doing is economists for nearly 200 years have ridiculed and dissed the idea of shorter work time sharing, that it's a fallacy, it's a lump of labor fallacy. And my poster and taking this taunt and turning it into a positive strategy to advance the idea of shorter working time and work sharing. And that's all I'm going to go into because it gets pretty technical. The economics, I was talking to John DeGraff this morning about it, and his eyes glazed over in about 2 or 3 minutes. So I'll move on to what I took away from the conference. And what I took away was, is degrowth politically feasible? Now, even if we can find the technical approaches, the technical solutions to providing a good way of life without economic growth, are the politicians going to buy it? Is the general public going to buy it? How do we move that ahead? And one of the challenges, I think, really comes from the awkwardness of the term degrowth. Now, my experience in Barcelona is that there were, you know, possibly not 500 different interpretations of what people meant by degrowth, but quite a variety of interpretations. Some people thought that meant that the economy shrunk. Some people thought that it meant that we just abandoned the imperative of growth. But rather than try to argue over definitions, what I'm going to do is propose that we add a second term to degrowth to make it a pair of terms, and that's regrowth. So it can be degrowth, regrowth. Because regrowth suggests renewal, it suggests rejuvenation and rebirth, a renaissance, really. So we can think of degrowth as pruning back the tangled overgrowth of high finance and the dead wood of militarism to make room for the tender green shoots of sustainability and social justice. I think the metaphor that I alluded to at the beginning, the 12-step metaphor, is actually quite apt here. In the 12-step programs, the first step is recognizing that growth has made us lose control of our lives. But there are still 11 more steps, and those involve spiritual renewal, spiritual awakening, taking some kind of assessment of the harm we've been doing and making amends for that, and really charting a new path for our lives and following that path. So it's not enough just to go cold turkey on growth. We need to also have a new way forward. And I think that the Sustainable Development Commission actually did have a 12-step program in their report, Prosperity Without Growth. It was called 12 Steps to a Sustainable Society. So I'm going to wrap up now, and I just want to say in closing, growthaholics of the world, relax.
That was Tom Walker giving his impressions of the second International Degrowth Conference in Barcelona, Spain. Now we go to our feature presentation, an overview of the world's fossil energy predicament from Dave Hughes, speaking at the first Degrowth Conference in North America in Vancouver, Canada, and introduced by Rex Whaler.
Ladies and gentlemen, our colleague and friend Dave Hughes has spent decades inside the Canadian Geological Survey of Canada, 32 years. He knows what's going on under the ground all over the world. He's documented the environmental constraints associated with coal and gas resources in Canada. He's on the board of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. He's on the board of the Post Carbon Institute. Again, this is someone who's paid his dues, done his homework, knows what he's talking about, has worked inside the industry, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about our energy future. This lifestyle we're living, this lifestyle where we can waste stuff, I guarantee you, for most of human civilization, people in communities, you don't waste stuff. You'd get booted out of most communities for most of human history if you wasted stuff. People took care of things. They fixed them when they were broken. They saved every resource they could save. We've lived in a very wasteful time, and that's because of this energy bonanza that we found about 150 years ago under the ground. Let me remind you of something. That energy bounty that we found 150 years ago under the ground represents 500 million years of stored solar energy that's retrievable. And each year right now, and Dave and I talked about this on email a few months ago and did the calculation. Each year now, we are burning 5 million years worth of stored solar energy that's recoverable. So in 1 year, we're taking the energy from 5 million years of solar energy converted to biomass, and we're burning it. That's what's allowing us to bop around and take airplanes and buy trinkets from China and everywhere else. And this is over. And if you ever doubted that it was over, listen to this. Now from Cortez Island in British Columbia, ladies and gentlemen, Dave Hughes.
Thanks very much, Rex. When Rex asked me to speak at a degrowth symposium, I went on the net and looked at the Paris site and some of the things that were there talking about a transition. I've been on the lecture circuit on energy now for just about 10 years. And I'm utterly convinced that degrowth is not an option. We can either intelligently plan a transition to a much lower energy footprint going forward, or Mother Nature will manage that transition for us. And I think it behooves us to listen to a lot of the things that are being said here tonight and in the next few days. Well, in keeping with a Stanley Cup theme, I'd like to talk a bit about hockey sticks, in particular hockey stick graphs with the blade turned upward. We have the disputed hockey stick of global temperature produced by Michael Mann and the indisputable hockey stick graph of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere based on the data from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. There are many other hockey stick graphs that can be produced as a result of the explosion in growth over the past few decades, the increase in global population, the number of motor vehicles, the increase in petroleum-based fertilizers to grow our food, the number of personal computers, the number of cell phones, the number of TV sets, the number of Starbucks outlets, and so forth. There are also hockey sticks with the blade turned downward. These include the number of fish in the oceans, the biodiversity of our ecosystems, the land area covered by old-growth forests. In medicine, it's generally considered advisable to treat the underlying problem, not its symptoms. These hockey sticks are in most ways symptoms of the underlying problem, which is our profligate and unsustainable consumption of fossil fuels. Energy is indeed the mother of all hockey sticks. It's really allowed us to do this damage to our planet. If we look at just the past four decades of consumption of energy, human beings have tripled their rates of consumption. Huge growth in the Asia-Pacific region, lesser growth in Europe and North America. If we look at growth in consumption by fuel, oil is our number one source of fuel, followed by coal and natural gas. But together, fossil fuels make up 86% of our primary energy consumption. The balance, large hydro, nuclear, and all of the other forms of renewables, wind, photovoltaics, geothermal, and so forth. If we look at a little bit further back, this goes back to the end of the last ice age. Human beings made it out of the last ice age with 3 million people. It took us 6,500 years to triple that population to 10 million when we figured out agriculture. Roughly 200 million at the time of Christ, a billion in 1810, 6.8 billion today. Humankind is in a very unique period of its evolutionary existence. And a lot of that explosion in growth is a result of fossilized sunshine. If we look at the last 500 years of that period, we can see that we really got started on coal in about 1700, oil, 1859, natural gas in 1885. And the growth in consumption of energy and population is very highly correlated. Per capita consumption of the human race, the average citizen of the world by fuel, 1850 to 2008. It turns out that the average citizen of the world is using the same amount of renewable energy today as he was in 1850. Problem is that the average citizen is consuming eight times as much energy as in 1850. People think of coal as a 19th century fuel, but in fact, the average citizen of the world consumes the same amount of fuel today as in 1910. Oil really allowed us to increase our total per capita consumption. It didn't really displace coal at all. Natural gas increased it further still, uranium further still. The problem is 89% of our per capita consumption is non-renewable, oil, gas, coal, and uranium. And so this is what I term the energy sustainability dilemma. There's 5.3 times as many people as in 1850. Each person is consuming 8.6 times as much energy on a per capita basis. The world is consuming 46 times as much energy as in 1850. 89% of that is non-renewable. Most of those fuels will have a peak in production in the first half of this century. If you remember three words from this lecture, remember these three. Beware of scale. The 86% of our primary energy we get from fossil fuels is a lot of energy. Less than 1% of primary energy consumption is now provided by non-hydropower renewables. There are no scalable alternatives to hydrocarbons at the rates of energy throughput we enjoy at this point in time. Unconventional hydrocarbon production is difficult to scale compared to the cheap hydrocarbons of yesteryear. Tar sands, extra heavy oil, biofuels simply cannot be scaled fast enough to come anywhere near close to replacing the throughput of cheap liquids we enjoy today. If we look at consumption of oil by the human race, first oil well, 1859. As of year end 2008, we consumed 1.1 trillion barrels of oil. That's somewhere between half and a third of all the oil that will ever be consumed. What gets me about this chart is 90% of this oil has been consumed since 1960. half of it since 1986, and 10% since 2005. So we're on a vicious uphill spiral of consumption of oil. If we look at production and consumption of oil by geopolitics, the non-OPEC world outside of the former Soviet Union produced 39% of the world's oil in 2008, but consumed 84% of it. Non-OPEC production peaked in 2002. All non-OPEC production, including the former Soviet Union, peaked in 2007. OPEC produced 45% of the world's oil and consumed only 11%. But OPEC countries are consuming far more of their oil internally with less oil to export. Discoveries of oil globally, the green bars are the amount of oil discovered each year. The black line is the amount of oil consumed. World oil discoveries peaked in about 1965, and since 1983, we've consumed more oil than we've discovered in each year. So we're really eating into the oil bank account of previous discoveries, consuming 3 to 4 barrels of oil for every barrel that we're finding. Peak oil, more and more talk about when world oil production will peak. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Difficult to predict exactly when because of the variables, but it depends on how much is there, how much is recoverable at a net energy profit, and how fast we consume it, a function of price, infrastructure, and so forth. Many forecasts of when world oil production will peak. Colin Campbell published a watershed study in New Scientist back in the late 90s about peak oil. Colin Campbell is certain that world oil production peaked in 2008. There's been many other published estimates. The real optimists on peak oil are located in Washington. The statistical arm of the U.S. Department of Energy, the Energy Information Administration, suggesting world oil production may not peak until 2044. The median of these estimates is 2015, and if you take out the two high ones, it's 2012, which is tomorrow in terms of planning to mitigate the effects of peak oil. You can go on the EIA's website and download their reference case forecast. Basically, smooth growth in production of oil through 2030 at least. I'd just like to point out unconventional oil, things like tar sands, biofuels. Even if we quadruple unconventional oil, it can't offset the declines in cheap liquids after peak oil. Many geologists would suggest we'll never get past about 95 million barrels a day. We're at 86 right now. And that will occur in the right about now, or maybe as late as 2014. This is what world oil production looks like over the last decade. The world has, in fact, been on a production plateau since early 2005. We had a peak to date in 2008. Non-OPEC, as I mentioned, peaked in 2007. The only question is, will more investment allow us to resume the growth in oil production? We spend a few trillion dollars on upstream oil and gas exploration. The story of oil production in Canada is a story about tar sands. The reference case calls for a tripling of tar sands production by 2020 in this case. If we actually could do that, Canada would be about 4% of forecast world oil demand. The concept of net energy, energy return on investment, is extremely important with fossil fuels. In the good old days in Saudi Arabia, the net energy payback from drilling an oil well and producing that oil was about 100 to 1. Today, 25 to 1. Tar sands, mineable tar sands, about 6 to 1. In situ tar sands, 3 to 1. Things like ethanol from corn, somewhere between 25% energy negative to 25% energy positive, a very poor source of liquid fuels. If we look at natural gas, we got started a bit later with gas than we did with oil. We've consumed about 500 billion barrels of oil equivalent of natural gas as of 2008. Again, very striking. 90% of all the natural gas burned to date has been burned since 1965, half of it since 1991, and 10% of it since 2006. So we're on the same uphill spiral of consumption with gas as we are with oil. Production of and consumption of natural gas has more than tripled since 1970 in the world. North America produced and consumed about 30% of the world's gas in 2008. Peak gas likely to be further out than peak oil. This is a projection by Colin Campbell suggesting a global peak in gas in about 2045. If we look at Canadian gas production, we're on what I call an exploration treadmill. In 1996, we drilled 4,000 successful gas wells. We quadrupled that to nearly 16,000 wells in 2005. We grew production by about 10% until we hit a plateau, and now production in Canada is in quite a steep decline. We only found enough gas to replace production in about three of the last 12 years. This is what Canadian gas production looks like now. This contains data up until December 2009. It's now falling at about 8.2% per year. Yet people like Apache are talking about building a pipeline to Kitimat and building an LNG liquefaction facility to export Canadian gas. I scratch my head when I hear this. The story about gas is that the declines are much quicker with gas than they are for oil. And this is production of Canadian gas by the year the well was drilled. And it turns out that 60% of Canadian production comes from wells drilled in the last 6 years. So if you have to keep drilling to keep production flat. The NEB's forecast of Canadian gas production through 2012, they're suggesting a 17% decline. I suggest that's probably optimistic. Going forward, the NEB is generally pretty optimistic. They're suggesting a radical turnaround just beyond their short-term forecast. I'll believe that when I see it. If you look at the U.S., the story about overall declines in the U.S. is even worse than Canada. 60% of their production comes from wells drilled in the last 4 years. Their overall decline per year is about a third. So a third of production has to be replaced by more drilling each year. Nonetheless, the EIA is very optimistic about gas production in the U.S. People like T. Boone Pickens are talking about replacing the fleet with natural gas-powered vehicles. There's a lot of hype about shale gas, a quintupling in this forecast, and an overall growth in production from the lower 48 of about 22% by 2035. How realistic is that? Not very. It turns out that the U.S. is on the same exploration treadmill that Canada's on. They almost quadrupled the number of wells from 10,000 in the late 90s to 36,000 in 2008, just about the time Lehman Brothers collapsed. So they drilled 200% more wells. They grew production by about 15%. The story about shale gas, which is hailed really as the great new source of gas in the U.S., is a story about very high decline rates. The first year decline rate of a typical shale gas well is 65%. Some of them are as high as 85%. So again, more drilling to keep production flat. This is what I would see as a reasonable scenario for U.S. gas supply going forward. If they can hold their declines to about 1.8% per year, they'll be short 40% of their forecast demand by 2035 going forward. The story of natural gas is also a story about net energy. As we go down the food chain to lower quality sources of gas, we need to invest more and more energy getting the gas compared to the energy we get back. Coal bed methane wells, for example, are a lot of very low productivity wells, so we need to drill a lot more of them.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.